Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Women are disproportionately impacted by the climate crisis. Floods, droughts, and extreme temperatures overwhelmingly affect women in the short and long term. In some cases, women make up almost 90% of casualties during dangerous climate events, and the majority of those displaced in the aftermath. Despite the disparities, women are underrepresented at every level of decision-making about the future of our planet. In her new book, Intertwined, Women, Nature, and Climate Justice, today's guest, wildlife biologist Dr. Rebecca Cormos, elevates the voices of women working to prevent the climate crisis, weaving together their stories to make a powerful case for why women are essential to changing our current trajectory toward catastrophic global warming and environmental degradation. Dr. Rebecca Cormos says empowering women is one of the most important solutions to the climate crisis and biodiversity loss. Women's leadership and equal representation is directly linked to lower CO2 emissions, better forest management, better land protection, less land grabbing, and fewer conflicts over resources. The science is so clear. We need to cut current global emissions in half by 2030 and then in half again by 2040. And then we need to cut emissions to net zero by 2050 at the very least. So why have women been left out of the public discourse on climate change at all levels? And how would the inclusion of women help us find solutions for our fragile planet? What is actually happening today that deserves more attention? Dr. Rebecca Cormos is a primatologist, wildlife biologist, conservationist, filmmaker, National Geographic explorer, and one of the co-founders of the Women in Nature Network. Her new book is called Intertwined, Women, Nature, and Climate Justice. Hi, Rebecca. Thank you so much for writing this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on your show, and it's really nice to meet you.
Well, it's nice to meet you, and you provide so many interesting facts and details in the book about how women are most affected by the climate crisis. It was interesting to learn that for most of your life as an environmentalist, you have worked primarily with men. So can you talk more about that and talk about what really inspired you to write this book?
Yeah, sure. I do admit that at the very beginning of the book, because it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, because I wanted to understand why, despite the fact that I'm a woman, I had carried these biases with me as well. I think, you know, when I worked in Central Africa, in Gabon, and in West Africa, in Guinea, I wanted to understand the threats to chimpanzees. And so I thought, you know, the most important thing would be to work with hunters. And to work with the heads of villages. But it wasn't until I went back to Guinea, you know, 20 years later, that with my friend and filmmaker, Kalyani Mam, when she said, no, you know, we're actually going to talk to women in the villages to hear what they have to say about relationships with chimpanzees. And the stories that I heard were so different. And I was actually quite ashamed that I had never sought out women's voices before. And this is what really launched me onto wanting to write this book.
You write about that in the book. When you were on that trip in Guinea, you met Niamnamna Traore, and you asked her if you could talk with her about the chimpanzees, and she said, nobody ever asked me what I think before.
Exactly. That was the epiphany for me. I just thought, wow, like, why hadn't I, you know, I've traveled throughout Guinea for 2 years, but really centered my interviews and my work with men. And when we heard stories from Niamnama, they were really interesting, ones that I hadn't heard, you know, 2 decades before. And we continued to interview women throughout the country. And a lot of these stories, you know, centered around conflicts over water sources. And one of the reasons for that, and that I hadn't heard it before, is because women primarily in this area are water carriers to, you know, in 8 out of 10 households, women are have the responsibility of providing water for the household. And so they would go to water sources, and often the same water sources as chimpanzees. And so there could be conflicts, or they would just each take their turn. But it was fascinating because I hadn't heard these stories before, because they hadn't been listening to half the population.
I think that is so interesting. And I commend you really for putting that out there to say that you never really thought about talking to women before. I think sometimes we can get used to still this male dominated society. And in your case, for example, it can just hit you all of a sudden. I mean, it's not like you didn't care about these issues. You've dedicated your life to environmental justice. I mean, working with chimpanzees, the list goes on. But it's just so interesting how we can be so conditioned to not really question these things without even thinking about it.
Exactly. And there's a beautiful quote from Liza Williams in one of the beginnings of the chapters that talks about how, you know, we can't work within the same systems if we want to change things. And I think one of the problems that I had before is science, and the area that I was in was very male dominated. And so I think I just fit right into those narratives and just, you know, continued on with my work. How, you know, most people worked and without really questioning it. And so I think it's a huge lesson for me, and also learning all the other things about how it's incredibly important for women to be involved in these conversations, if not lead them.
We should also note that you highlight in the introduction that when you use the word women, you refer to cis women, trans women, non-gender conforming people, two-spirit. I think that's so important, because before the colonizers arrived in many countries, there were two-spirit people. That deserves, I think, a lot more attention given the conversation we're having today. Non-binary. So I think that's important just to mention.
Yes, and thank you so much. I mentioned that right at the beginning of the book, because I think it's incredibly important to be inclusive in when we're speaking about women.
Just to give people some visuals about this, because so much is happening so quickly. I mean, to see the tornadoes in Texas, and there was actually, given that you're on the show today, we were just looking to see if there were any examples of what you describe, you know, happening recently. And there were. There is an article in Nation about how there were some flooding in Kenya, and women were disproportionately impacted by this. It just happened recently. So if we can talk about some of the examples that you lay out in your book. You mentioned what happened in Guinea, of women walking further for water. And there's so many examples here about women and girls spending longer searching for and fetching water and fuel wood, not only stealing their time away from their education and their paid work, but this sometimes puts them in danger because they're walking further, and sometimes they have to walk at night. So can you lay out some of these other examples here about how this climate crisis has really affected women and girls the most, and in some cases put them in danger?
Yeah, it's when I first started looking at the data and the information about how, you know, the proportion of women that are impacted, I was just blown away. 90%, even 91% of women, you know, mortalities in certain extreme climate events. And that's just unfathomable to me. So I really wanted to go in depth into the literature and find out why. And, you know, everything I read and learned about made it made total sense. And it just really emphasizes that it's not to do with our sex. It's to do with our gender. It's to do with societies, the roles that they place on us, the responsibilities. And it also, poverty is a really big part of it, mm-hmm. because women are more dependent, therefore, on, you know, water and in rivers and natural resources. And, you know, we can't turn on a tap in many places in the world to get water. But the roles, like I said before, the roles of water carrier are often ascribed to women, and also for collecting fuel wood. And so as we cut down forests and as rivers dry up or get polluted, women are having to walk much further. But there's so many other things as well. You know, again, to do with poverty or when there aren't enough, there isn't enough food to go around, girls are actually being married off earlier in during droughts, which is has, you know, catastrophic impacts on their lives and repercussions for generations to come. But there are crazy things too, like, you know, clothing that women are expected to wear, you know, during a flood can weigh women down. It's difficult to swim when you have all these wraps of material. Women are taught less to swim than men are. And women have less access to cell phones or the internet than men do. And so all of these factors, and so many more, you know, really combine to make women much more vulnerable, vulnerable in the climatic sense, not in terms of vulnerability as we as a sex, because we are not vulnerable as a sex. It's the gendered expectations and roles and responsibilities that make us more vulnerable to climate change.
And other things you point out that just deserve so much more attention. When fuel wood gets scarcer, women must walk farther with these heavy loads on their heads. This physical burden has been linked to spine damage as well as complications during pregnancy and even maternal mortality. Walking alone farther from home increases the chances of being sexually harassed or assaulted. In Darfur, for example, women and girls have been attacked while gathering water. You've got so many examples of sexual violence. In some cases, they're forced to enter forests where they've reported being attacked by elephants. And so there are just lots of examples here that I think a lot of people wouldn't even really think about.
Yeah, it's the book is you can kind of see the two sides of my personality in it, because I'm a scientist. And so I just packed it with as much data as I could, like, you know, look in this country and all this information. But then I also, you know, when you think about what that really means and hear the stories of women who shared, you know, to have their stories in this book, it's incredibly moving and unjust as well. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's pretty shocking. And you know, it's from a rights-based point of view, it's not fair and it needs to be changed. But, you know, also from a conservation point of view, it means that certain projects are not successful as well, because if women's voices aren't incorporated. And so, you know, women will go into protected areas even if they're not allowed to, if they need to collect firewood to cook meals. So, yeah.
Right. Because also in some cases, because of the climate crisis, men have to leave to try to get a job, which leaves women at home taking care of the children, in many cases, their parents. I mean, thinking about food, for example, you write that women are often responsible for foraging for wild fruits, vegetables, leaves, seeds. In the last 40 years, we've lost 60% of global population of mammals, birds, fish, reptiles, and amphibians. When wildlife as a food source becomes scarcer, there's greater reliance on women to provide the family with enough daily calories through these other wild foods. So there's a reason in many cases why women are left alone to raise the family and provide the family with what they need.
Yeah, exactly. And so many of the women spoke about this and that they had observed this in places where they worked. And it happens, you know, across the globe that when it's difficult to grow food crops, often, you know, the only solution is, you know, men leave and go to cities to try and get jobs and send money back home. But this does leave women with the responsibility of tending the crops, of taking care of the children, of everything. And when there are, you know, catastrophes with the environment or crops fail, then women are responsible for holding everything together. And that really takes a toll. And that's linked with poverty too, because women are much more likely to live in these, you know, single parent households than men are.
And it was interesting to learn that these single parent households are increasing in all developing regions. It's been increasing since the 1990s. In sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean, lone mother households make up 100% of all households.
Yeah, it's crazy. There's one a man actually that I talked to for this book talked about going in to an area in Guinea where he worked, and that almost the whole village it's single women taking care of children because you know, men had left to go and earn money elsewhere. And often that money does get sent back home and it does help, but sometimes, you know, it's not in a situation where money makes that much difference. And also sometimes the money, you know, men do stay in the cities and the money doesn't make it back home. So it's a really difficult changing dynamic.
Right. And of course, this is all unpaid work for these women to be primary caregivers for their children and in some cases their parents.
Yes, exactly. And those were some of the statistics that really, really shocked me, but also unfortunately rang true. Even here, you know, in California, talking with my women friends and, you know, that, unpaid care work of children and house care, women take on so much, of a greater proportion of that. And there, you know, there are some crazy things like, you know, for example, it changes depending on which country you're in. But in India, you know, men contribute 36 minutes of unpaid care work compared to 6 hours of unpaid care work for women on average. And this makes a difference in terms of what kind of jobs women can get as well. And I've experienced this myself, too, you know, that when you have responsibilities taking care of children or the house, that it's hard to have a full-time job or to travel. And so often it's interesting that women take on, you know, part-time jobs. But unfortunately, that means those jobs sometimes don't have, you know, benefits or the security, which, again, can make women more vulnerable to, you know, sort of climate catastrophes as well.
Hmm. Today, we are spending the hour with Dr. Rebecca Kormos. We're talking about her new book, Intertwined, Women, Nature, and Climate Justice. She elevates the voices of women working to prevent the climate crisis by weaving together their stories to make a powerful case for why women are essential to changing our trajectory toward catastrophic global warming and environmental degradation. In the book, there are so many examples of how the climate crisis greatly affects women, whether we're talking about floods, rising temperatures. We were just talking about how women are being forced to walk further for wood and for water. And also, and we're going to talk about this next, women are underrepresented at every level of decision making about the future of the planet. And I just want to let you know, I know things can be really heavy, especially when we talk about the climate crisis. She does interview and highlight so many women doing such amazing and important work in her book, and we'll also talk about that. If you'd like to join the conversation, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you'd like to talk about how women in your area are working on the climate crisis, we'd love to hear from you about how women are greatly affected by the crisis. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Before we talk about how women are missing from so many levels of finding solutions to this crisis, let's talk about some of the examples that you lay out about how women were greatly affected by these crises. When a cyclone hit Myanmar in 2008, 61% of fatalities were women. In New Orleans, most victims trapped because of Hurricane Katrina were women and children. During the 2003 heat wave in Europe, nearly two-thirds of those who died were women. And then in the 2009 tsunami that hit Samoa and Tonga, about 70% of the adults who died were women. So can you explain, why is this happening? Why are the numbers so high for women?
Yeah, I thank you so much for talking about how this can feel kind of heavy sometimes. And I'm really glad we're also going to talk about, you know, the hope, which is one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book as well, because women, you know, have done such incredible things in the conservation and in the space. So I'd love to talk about that too. But it is really important to realize that these statistics that of how many women are affected is just devastating. And there was one paper that I read that said, you know, this isn't actually new. We've known this, you know, for decades now. And so it is unfathomable that if we've known this for decades, then why aren't women's voices, you know, central at climate change negotiations, for example? But yes, your question about, you know, and other reasons why women are so impacted, it's just, you know, as caregivers to children, and as primary caregivers to children and to the elderly and to the sick, sometimes women cannot flee as quickly because they are helping children along. They are, you know, staying with the sick and not leaving, or staying with the elderly and not leaving. So that is another factor that's at play as to why women are more impacted.
It was also interesting to learn that in many cases, there's no way to give women warnings about what is coming.
Yeah, that is, it's crazy because, so I mentioned before that, you know, if you look at statistics worldwide, men have cell phones more often than women do. And men also have access to the internet and so can receive these early warning systems earlier. But also sometimes, you know, information is posted in public spaces where women aren't allowed to go. And women across the world, you know, have lower literacy rates than men do. And so even if there are signs with information, then women can't necessarily take on the information that way. So yes, it's a huge factor in it.
And that, again, is a reason why you say that empowering women is so critical to dealing with these crises. Can we also talk about the sexual violence that is connected to things like droughts, floods, tsunamis, fires? You write that we have to look at what happens after the floods or after the fires. And unfortunately, I feel like while the crisis is getting a lot of media attention, because there's so many, we tend to jump from crisis to crisis. And it's pretty rare to say, okay, what actually happened in you know, Myanmar, in Nepal, in Bengal afterward? And you write that women are asked for sexual favors after the fact for their share of food distributions, and they also suffer increased physical and sexual violence. An increase in gender-based violence was documented in Canterbury, New Zealand, after the 2010 and 2011 earthquakes, in Haiti after the 2010 earthquake, the Philippines after the 2013 typhoon. I mean, the list is just so long. Yeah. The UN estimates over 3 million women and children were at risk of rape, sexual exploitation, violence, and trafficking after the 2015 earthquake in Nepal. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's just so much evidence out there about, you know, what happens within, you know, temporary encampments when people have to flee. One of the problems is that women lose their support networks as well, often, you know, with other family members nearby. And, but yes, and unfortunately, this seems to happen in refugee camps, and it's something that's quite well known as an after effect to these, you know, climate disasters. And another thing that's just so tragic about it too is that, you know, with all everything going on, women often lose access to birth control, you know, either because it's been washed away or there are no clinics open or you can't get to one of the clinics. And so the implications of this are just, you know, huge. And again, intergenerational.
Right. And to think that in many cases, because of the catastrophic damage, the reproductive health clinics and the pharmacies are damaged or closed. Another issue that is just directly connected to the climate crisis.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, the thing also, you know, with the degradation of the environment and the loss of species, you know, in fisher communities, and this doesn't have to do with climate disasters, but it has to do with the, you know, long-term degradation of the environment. But women are, you know, when they have less access to fish to feed their families, sometimes they need to trade things. And sometimes that involves, you know, sexual favors as well. And so the rate of women with AIDS in these fisher communities is increasing really rapidly.
We're going to take a quick break. Today, we're speaking with Dr. Rebecca Cormos about her new book, Intertwined, Women, Nature, and climate justice. After a break, we will talk about why women are underrepresented at every level of decision making, about the future of our planet. We'll find out what is being done about that. And then we will talk about solutions. Rebecca says empowering women is one of the most important solutions to the climate crisis and biodiversity loss. She lays out so much information about what needs to change and then speaks to a number of women around the globe who are working on this. Today, it's Your Calls One Planet series, and you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have a related conversation. We'll discuss the connections between our food choices and the climate crisis, deforestation, water scarcity, world hunger. The list, of course, is so long. A 2018 science study says avoiding or greatly reducing meat and dairy is the single biggest way to reduce your impact on the earth. And we're talking here about people who actually have food choices. Activists say we must act swiftly and motivate millions of people around the globe to take action. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can give us, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. And if you'd like to join today's conversation with Dr. Rebecca Cormos about her new book, Intertwined, Women, Nature, and Climate Justice, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Rebecca, before we dive in and talk about what the data says about why women are not at the table. As we mentioned, you've done a lot of work with chimpanzees. You're a primatologist, a wildlife biologist. You've done so much work. Can you talk to us about how you got into this work and tell us more about your relationship with nature?
Oh, yeah, thank you. Oh my gosh, I think ever since I was born, I've just been so drawn to nature. And you know, having Jane Goodall, we had books around our house written by Jane Goodall. And so it made this idea that I could go and live in the wild, you know, possible for someone who was born in a city. But I've always loved nature. And as soon as I could get to Africa to study chimpanzees, I did. And so I lived in a research camp in Central Africa for 3 years. And then I did a survey of chimpanzees in Guinea in West Africa for 2 years. After those experiences, it was very difficult to come back to, you know, working in cities, but I worked at the headquarters of CI and World Wildlife Fund, you know, continuing to try and do what I could to protect nature. But how I got into this work, you know, I was very species focused at the beginning, like really focused on chimpanzees, and then it became broader knowing that, you know, we've got to protect the whole ecosystem in order to protect biodiversity. And then, you know, in 2018, when I went to make that film with Callie Annie, that's when I really started thinking about issues of gender and how that affects conservation and why women aren't included equally. But there was also a really important moment that I mentioned in the book. I don't know if the California listeners here remember, like, you know, that day when the sun didn't come up, when we had those orange skies and COVID was raging across the planet and we didn't have a vaccine yet, with all the wildfires. And I decided at that point, I had been working with mining companies and trying to decrease their impact. And it was quite depressing work. And I knew in my heart that I had to focus on something that was hopeful. And in all the work I had been doing recently with women and webinars that I had been attending, that's where I really found hope. And so that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to write this book as well.
What has it been like to work so closely with chimpanzees? I mean, for so many of us, we see the photos, we see the videos, but most of us will never come into contact with a chimpanzee. You're very lucky.
I'm very lucky. It has been absolutely incredible. You know, I have to say that it wasn't an experience like, you know, you see with some researchers when they're really close to the chimpanzees and able to observe their behavior, because The chimpanzees that I worked with were not used to humans. And so when they saw us, they'd usually, you know, leave quickly. And so they weren't long observations. But every time I had the chance to be near chimpanzees and to observe them in the wild, it was the most incredible thing, because it was like meeting an ancestor, somebody who I'm extremely connected to, and yet had so much knowledge and the ability to live in the wild that I wish I did, that I didn't have. So if, you know, I mentioned in the book, it was not like, you know, humans sometimes think of themselves as superior to nature, but it's when you meet a chimpanzee in the wild, you definitely don't feel superior. You feel that they are superior because they have all this knowledge that you don't have.
And I wonder how you and your colleagues talk about these issues, finding a balance between sharing the devastating news, but also letting people know that there are great people around the globe doing such good work. Like, for example, we talked about your experience meeting Niamnama Traore when you were in Guinea. And I struggle with this on the show because, you know, every Monday we talk about the climate crisis. We decided to do this after the 2016 election because we knew that these issues wouldn't get the attention they deserve. Whether it's, you know, speaking to people doing such good work like you or doing shows about chimpanzees. And this is such a struggle because we have to know what's going on, but it's so heavy. I mean, you write about the forests of Busu in Guinea becoming degraded and the corridor of the trees between Busu and nearby forests being cut down. When you visited the same mountain in the mid-1990s, there were 24 chimpanzees. By the end of 2023, there were only four left. I mean, how do you and your colleagues talk about how to get this information out there without leaving people in such a state of despair? Because that's where we are right now. And yet there are people doing such good work.
It is so true. And it is so difficult. And I think many people working in the climate space struggle with how to communicate that. And there was a funny incident that happened with my book, because somebody said that, where should we display your book? Like, in what section of a bookstore? And they said, because the climate crisis section of the bookstore is never visited by anybody.
Really?
So, you know, people don't really necessarily want to hear these things or read about them, and yet it's just so important for our future. But that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write the book, is to hear these stories of hope from women. And I did ask that question at the very end, you know, do you feel hope? And if so, where do you find that hope? And it was incredible just to hear how much hope women still have about the future of the planet, despite being on the front lines of climate change. And that made me feel like, you know, if people who are really struggling with this have hope, then I need to keep that hope. And that is what's needed to be able to combat climate change more quickly. But finding that balance is incredibly tricky. But, you know, keeping people's awe and being inspired by the beauty and the creativity and the, you know, of nature is so important, because if we don't hold on to that, you know, this is what we're fighting for, and for the health of everybody on all living creatures on the planet. If we lose that, then, you know, then there's no hope. So we really need to hold on to why we're doing this.
And also to highlight these stories. So a story that you highlight that is promising is about an all-female ranger patrol in Zimbabwe. And you met Nyarazo Hoto, a One Earth climate hero, a sergeant, just to talk about the work that she does. And she says the biggest challenges were not the physical ones, but the attitudes of people toward the women. She says, we were so excited and interested to be part of the team. I can say the only challenge that was faced was the misconception of the community. They didn't believe that women could be rangers. The men were mocking us and saying bad things about us. They said we were taking over their duties. But now people are understanding why we're doing this work, through our success, through the arrests we made, and through the projects we're doing around the concession. The population of wildlife has increased. Can you tell us more about this?
Yes. Nyarazo Hoto is the most incredible woman, and you can read about her in the book, but you can also read about her online, because she won a Ranger of the Year award a few years ago. But she is, you know, she in her life, and you can read about it in the book, but she faced a lot of hurdles. And she, you know, was taken out of school early to help support her family. And then she married very young because she thought that that would, you know, help her life. But her husband was abusive. And so she ended up going back to her family and planting tomatoes and selling tomatoes in a market to try and support her family. And then when this program started, the Akashingas, which means the brave ones, Damien Mander, who led it, you know, gathered women who wanted to participate in this and try out for it. And when he had done something similar with men, you know, putting the men through this really, really rigorous training, in the end, I think it's like out of 100 men, there were 3 left that could, you know, really make it through this training. And when they did the same training with the women, only 3 women dropped out voluntarily out of the whole training. So, you know, Nia Radzo is absolutely incredible, and then moved up through the ranks, got her driver's license, which she didn't have before, and became a driver, and now is a sergeant. And the program's expanding, and she's gone back and furthered her education. And, you know, at the end of my interview with her, she just said, you know, I know what's possible. I can do this. Mm. And I think that's a real inspiration to everybody.
Such a great story. And she should be at the decision-making tables. To that point, let's not spend too much time on this because, again, the statistics are so dire. I mean, white men make up 75% of NGO CEO positions. We're talking about climate NGOs. When you look at the number of women publishing on climate change, the numbers are low. The funding for women working on these issues is low. And then this one, I thought, I had no idea. We cover COP every year. At COP26, so this was the climate conference that happened in 2021, women made up just over 1/4 of the total speaking time. In other words, as you write in your book, we were listening to men for almost 3/4 of the time. I mean, Rebecca, at a time when we're spending so much time saying we need to diversify these tables, these voices, these books, I mean, these numbers still, we have such a ways to go still.
We do. And it is, it's shocking, but I think that it actually is improving, which is wonderful in the conservation sector. And so I was really happy to see a new report has just come out, you know, since the book went to press. So it's not included, but showing that in the conservation sector, there's actually within conservation or nature, environmental organizations, there's actually a huge increase in the number of women leading them and then also employed by them and also on boards. So I was so happy to see that. But then I started thinking about, well, what about, you know, in mining companies, for example, what you know, some of the oil and gas companies. And if you look at that, wow, we're at like 7% women or something like that. So we do. We have such a long way to go, and especially at the COPs. And there is an organization called She Changes Climate that's really paying attention to this and writing letters to the COP organizers to insist that you know, more women's voices are heard.
You also write about filmmakers, and we want to give a shout out to Ana Blanco, who is head of the International Ocean Film Festival, because they feature so many women filmmakers every year. You also write about Latina scientists who are standing up saying we need more Latinas speaking on these issues. So as you say, there are, you know, changes are happening and people are doing such good work out there, but it is really important to just lay out those numbers. It's also important to highlight the fact that according to studies, when women are involved, forests, water, land, they're all protected. So let's dive in and talk about what the data says.
Yeah, this one I find incredible. And I've been, you know, combing through these papers as a scientist, really trying to understand the data. But it comes up time and time again. And there's really a plethora of information now in studies. Now it's showing that women's leadership and gender equality results in, you know, spectacular things when it comes to nature and to do with the climate. So, you know, from the national level to even, you know, the company level, increased women leadership is correlated with decreased carbon dioxide, you know, greenhouse gases going up into the atmosphere. And I am fascinated with why this is so. So I have some ideas, but, you know, there, when women are in leadership positions, more environmental treaties are signed as well. And then there's studies looking at, you know, gender equality in terms of forest management, and that forests are healthier and, you know, protected better when there's more gender equality in the groups that are making decisions about it. And, you know, people can talk about whether it's causal or not, but it is spectacular how many of these studies have really found out this relationship between women's leadership and better protection of nature.
And just to give a few examples, concrete examples, studies have found that in Bangladesh, when committees that oversee wetland management are more gender balanced, they're more effective in conserving the ecosystems. Another study in the Philippines revealed that management of the country's community-based marine protected areas had better conservation outcomes when women were involved in the decision making.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And the why, I think it's really interesting too. And one of the main things, it's like, you know, what I was talking about with Nyamnama, that if you're not listening to the whole population, you're not hearing the whole story about how people use resources or understanding, you know, how the women have, you know, sometimes because of the roles that they take on, that they have a special relationship to water. For example, if they're, you know, often at a river collecting water, or, you know, roots and tubers, if that's, you know, part of their day is collecting and harvesting those foods. And so women will, if as long as there are gender differences in the roles that women take on, women will have different knowledge. And if that's not included, then how can we design solutions?
And so, speaking of solutions, you have a lot of information in the book about the changes needed to empower women around the globe, ensuring rights and access to education, sexual and reproductive health services, and land ownership. And I have to say, I really had to take a deep breath on the reproductive health, because we're losing those rights here in the United States, which is every day, it's really shocking. But let's focus still on, well, and I should say this is important, because what happens in the United States greatly affects women overseas around reproductive health. We just did a show about how the Trump administration, you know, went further than any Republican president when it comes to limiting access to birth control, about ensuring that clinics do not get funding for even sanitary pads. So I think it's important to also make those connections to how, you know, what the United States does or doesn't do greatly affects women around the globe on a number of different issues.
Yeah, it's so important. It's a tricky subject to talk about sometimes, but I loved interviewing two of my interviews. One was with Sarah Ennis Lara, who lives in Colombia. And then Gladys Kalema Zikusoka, who runs a program in Uganda. And both these women have integrated sexual and reproductive health services into their work at the request of the communities that they work with. And, you know, Sarah says something in her book, you know, how can you ask a woman to do more, you know, when she's in a circumstance where she can't even control, you know, how many children she's having? And so it's so critical. And as you say, it's really important here in the U.S. So, we need to get it right.
Right. Well, let's talk more about some of the things that you lay out, and then we'll get to a couple of questions that have come via email. I mean, some of these are also very obvious, but we still need to highlight them because it's just not being done on the ground. When a girl is educated, she becomes a woman with a higher paid job later in life. When children complete their secondary education, their wages will increase by 9% for girls, 7% for boys. I mean, you've got so many statistics about the importance of education. And of course, the first thing you think about is Afghanistan, because what is going on there with education and how women and girls are not able to get an education there. And there were just some floods in Afghanistan, again, greatly affecting women. So can you talk more about just what stood out for you when you did your research about the importance of educating girls around the globe?
It gave me more hope than anything. And I feel like if I was going to relive my life and I wasn't allowed to work with chimpanzees, I would go into girls' education. Mm. Reading about what happens, it's just spectacular, the results, you know, that happen for women. I mean, I want it to, you know, remain rights-based. Women, girls have a right to equal education. Mm. But as well as that, when that girl, you know, grows up, that the benefits for her children and for her community, and then also for the environment and climate, are you know, really, really impressive and really important. This last summer, I went to Kenya and had the amazing opportunity to witness the work of an NGO called For the Good, who work in the Luita Hills area of Kenya, and they try and dismantle these barriers so that girls can stay in school. And they do this through all sorts of different things, from building schools to, you know, working with families and trying to change the way education for girls is perceived. But it is really amazing to see all the changes that happen when a girl is educated, not only for herself, but in so many different ways.
And again, the data just shows that, you know, as you've said, child marriages come down, for example, which tend to go up after a climate crisis. But when the community is educated, the numbers drop.
Exactly. Thank you for referring to those. Yeah, there's so many things tied in with education. And it's something that with so little investment can make such a huge difference. And so, yeah, I feel like focusing on girls' education would be, you know, something that people could do to even address the climate crisis.
Right. And then the other big one is unintended pregnancies. Those greatly drop with more education.
Yeah, exactly. And it's interesting, education of boys also, boys are more likely to use contraception if they have more years of education as well. So yeah, it's important for everybody.
Right. Are there any other research you'd like to talk about? I mean, land ownership is another important one because women own far less land than men.
Yeah, that was pretty shocking as well. I think it's 15% of all, you know, land that's owned is owned exclusively by women, 15% only. And that's an average across the globe. You know, in some countries it's 1%, in another countries it's more. But land ownership, again, is something incredibly important for women and to decrease poverty. And it's important, you know, there's less malnutrition if a woman owns land, her children are healthier, they are affected less by disease. But also, that land is better managed when women own land jointly or on their own.
We have a question from Sufi. He says, Rebecca, you're so inspirational. What would you say are the best actions those of us who are passionate about these issues can do? What would be most impactful?
Oh, I love that question. You know, I've been thinking about this a lot. I feel there's so many different levels that we can address this, but even within our own homes, you know, and with our friends, and then if we, you know, in our workplace, just ensuring that we're always asking the question, are we equally hearing the voice of everybody? Are women equally included, you know, from the board level to the, you know, employee level, but also, you know, within households as well. But then, you know, there are all these incredible networks. This is something I go into at the end of the book, that are supporting women. And I compare them to, you know, the mycorrhizals under the soil that are supporting trees with nutrients and allowing them to communicate. And so these organizations like Planet Women, Women in Nature Network, or Daughters for Earth and Women's Earth Alliance, they are supporting these women. And so getting involved in those different networks and organizations would really help, because they channel all this, you know, empowerment and funding, et cetera, to women who are working on the front lines of climate change. Unfortunately, they only receive, you know, 0.2% of all funding. But if we could boost those networks more, I think we could be reaching women more easily.
And then final thoughts. What are your thoughts about bringing together different movements across, you know, social, economic, gender, and environmental justice.
Oh, exactly. I feel like this is where the future is, because everything that, you know, history has been, has shows us is that we are stronger when we work together. And so many of these issues, you know, cross over, and by uniting all these different movements, we could be so much stronger. And so I think that's a really, really key message.
Dr. Rebecca Cormos is a primatologist, wildlife biologist, and conservationist. Her new book is Intertwined: Women, Nature, and Climate Justice. She's also one of the co-founders of the Women in Nature Network. And you can learn more about her work and her new book at yourcallradio.org. Rebecca, thank you so much for writing this important book, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. And we hope you can join us tomorrow. It will be a related conversation to today's discussion. We'll discuss the connections between our food choices and all of the issues we discussed today, things like deforestation, water scarcity, along with world hunger. In 2018, a study in Science says avoiding or greatly reducing meat and dairy is the single biggest way to reduce your impact on the earth. As long as you have choices, activists say there's still time, but we have to act swiftly and motivate millions of people around the globe to take action. We hope you can join us tomorrow. If you have a guest idea or a show idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.